RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
For those passionate about books and reading, welcome to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, recorded on location at the Wigtown Book Festival. In a packed show today, we'll chat to Lisa Owens about her book Not Working, Helen Sedgwick on The Comet Seekers, and Angus MacDonald on Ardnish Was Home. Guest director Hardeep Singh Kohli will be giving a rundown of his highlights, and comedian Susan Kalman will be discussing her bittersweet memoir, Cheer Up Love. With Adrian Sykes and Ian Fraser, we'll talk about the future of capitalism. With Jonathan King, the Von Hugo Fellow at the Museum for Archaeology and Anthropology, we'll explore the story of Native North America, and we'll hear how many authors have fussed over a guide dog. All that on today's Read On. Wigtown is a traditional market town set in the beautiful countryside of Dumfries and Galloway in southwest Scotland and close to the UK's first dark sky park. It's also Scotland's national book town, a designation that reflects its dozen or so second-hand bookshops and of course its annual literary festival. Founded in 1999, the 10-day Wigtown Book Festival is now one of the UK's best-loved literary gatherings, with events and activities for all ages, including music, theatre, food and visual arts. The event also supports the work of the charity Fight for Sight. Artistic director of the Wigtown Book Festival is Adrian Turpin.
The Wigtown Book Festival takes place over 10 days. We're in southwest Scotland in Galloway. I suppose what's special about the festival is that it grew out of a community project when Wigtown became Scotland's national book town. So it was awarded this status because it had so many bookshops. And the festival followed on from that. Even though it's professionally run, it's had an ethos of being very involved with the town. We're a town of 900 people, and yet we have over 100 volunteers working for us every year.
For the past few years, Fight for Sight has been one of the charities that's supported by the festival. Why is that important to you?
It's pretty hard to read if you can't see things, and it's a way of making that point. A book festival is a very effective way of making that point. There are a lot of people who are interested in visual arts. There are a lot of people who are interested in the Dark Skies project that takes place here. These are all things that we've been involved with when we put together our programme. So it was very clear that this idea about seeing the world was very important. And we have a lot of people who are very engaged who are coming from elsewhere.
Chief Executive of Fight for Sight is Michelle Acton.
I'm Michelle Acton and I'm Chief Executive of Fight for Sight. Fight for Sight is the main charity in the UK that's funding medical research into a wide range of different eye diseases and conditions. We're funding research that can help us find ways of preventing eye diseases and conditions, detecting them early, developing new treatments, and ultimately to help restore sight. We've had a large number of successes coming out of our research. We fund at the moment about 150 different research projects at top universities and hospitals around the UK. As a result of our funding, we're starting to see now world's first clinical trials for treatments for conditions for which there has never been a treatment developed. We were really pleased to be chosen as the charity partner for Wigtown Book Festival. It's a fantastic festival, and working in partnership with the festival, we can really help put across the message about how much we need funds and support for eye research.
Later in today's show, we'll talk to guest director Hardeep Singh Kohli, comedian Susan Kalman, and many more of the authors at this year's Wigtown Book Festival, first of whom is Lisa Owens. Claire Flannery has quit her job in order to discover her true vocation, only to realise she has no idea how to go about finding it. Meanwhile, all around her seem to have their lives entirely under control. Moving and hilarious, Lisa Owens' debut novel is A Bridget Jones Diary for the 21st Century. It's called Not Working, and the audio version is read by Tuppence Middleton.
Grandma told me at the funeral she knew the end was nigh when he started throwing away tea bags after only one soak.
It was as though a light had gone out, she said.
So is there anything I can do to help while I'm here? Grandma raises a hand and strikes it dismissively through the air.
You can't do anything.
Just drink your tea. Are you sure? I could change your sheets or do some cleaning or run down to the shops if there's anything you need. She's shaking her head.
Stuart changed the bedding with me this morning and Faye comes and hoovers once a week. The twins take it in turns to help me with the shopping. You'd be no use. You can't even drive.
I can drive, Grandma. I passed first time, remember? I just don't have a car. I wonder if senility is maybe sitting in. In the eyes of the family, passing first time has been my greatest achievement to date. My mother failed 3 times and Grandma herself took 5 attempts. And that was in the old days when everyone passed.
That's Tuppence Middleton reading from Not Working by Lisa Owens, available in audio now. And I'm with Lisa at the Wigtown Book Festival. Lisa, first of all, tell us about the book.
It's called Not Working. It's about a young woman called Claire Flannery. Her age is never actually stated, but she's probably in her late 20s, early 30s. And she gives up her job in creative communications in order to try and find her true purpose in life. No sooner has she left her job than she realises she's got no idea at all what that should be. So it's really about her trying to reckon with what she wants to do with her life. And at this time, she also ends up having sort of some difficulties with her family and her relationship. So it's about someone in flux, really.
Same thing, isn't it? What's the point of having a license if you don't bother to use it? Finish the biscuits, that's what I'd ask you to do.
Oh, go on then. I dunk a broken piece in my tea and half of it dissolves and disappears. Please have a think about something I can do. Laundry? Some gardening? Had no idea my cousins were so considerate. I'd always believed myself to be the thoughtful grandchild. I feel bad that I've done nothing, while they've seemingly been running a household between them. They must think I'm terrible.
I know you're not Claire, and I know you're the author, but there is a parallel in that you gave up work to write this.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't actually know this was going to be the book that I wrote when I gave up my job, but there are certainly parallels in the writing process, actually, the kind of, you know, the aimless days. You have to be in charge of your time, you have to try and make something happen for yourself, and actually that ended up coming through in quite an uncanny way in the book. Claire's sort of search for a job was mirroring my search to finish the book.
Now, your background in publishing and in editing, was that a help or a hindrance?
Ultimately a help. My agent was somebody that I had known in my previous incarnation, and so that definitely really made me sort of, you know, I managed to skip that whole slash pile aspect of getting a book deal. But being an editor, I think, can be a double-edged sword because it really made me a bit obsessed with every single word, and it probably slowed the process down in a funny way because I couldn't move on until something was absolutely how I wanted it to be.
Did you surprise yourself in the writing of it? Was there a point where you thought you didn't think Claire was going to do that?
It took on a life of its own in a funny way. It started with a sort of handful of vignettes and observations, and then it became this whole world of somebody who was really in quite a dark place, actually. And I think that really surprised me, her sort of soul-searching and the kind of, you know, the some people have asked, you know, is she depressed? Is she having a nervous breakdown? And I've never wanted to put labels on it, but she is certainly somebody who is really struggling in a way she hasn't probably before.
At home that evening, I'm still seething. She wouldn't even let me put on a wash for her. It's not fair telling someone they don't help when they've just offered to do absolutely anything for you. Speaking of washing, Luke says, I'm nearly out of clean shirts. He raises a hand when my mouth drops open. I only mentioned it because I'm putting one on and wondered if you had anything that needs doing. Please, I say. You haven't done a single load the whole time we've lived together. This isn't the time for grand gestures. I love you, Luke calls as I storm into the bedroom to gather the laundry for a whitewash.
The audio version read by Tubbins Middleton. Do you think that changes the reading experience, listening to it rather than reading it?
I think so. It's a book that I think, well, I spent a lot of time kind of figuring out how it should be on the page and how, you know, punctuation was very important to me. So I hope that it won't kind of radically change it. But I think definitely Tubbins has brought a new sort of life to it that you definitely wouldn't get on the page.
Office life. It's the little things you miss. Free pens, notebooks, coffee, the colour printer, the incidental conversation.
Not Working by Lisa Owens, read by Tuppence Middleton, is available commercially now. Still to come, Susan Kalman on Cheer Up Love, Helen Sedgwick on The Comet Seekers, and next, Wigtown Book Festival guest director Hardeep Singh Kohli.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Reading is essential to feeling included and independent, but when experiencing sight loss, gaining access to the same magazines and newspapers as your peers can be a challenge. RNIB Newsagent can remove those barriers. Whether you're interested in the daily papers, Reader's Digest or BBC Good Food, our service can deliver a wide range of popular titles in formats to suit you. Prices start from just £25 a year, and if you pay by direct debit, we'll give you a 20% discount. To find out more and request a copy of our new catalogue or sample magazine, please call RNIB's helpline on 0303 123 9999.
I think the whole talking book scheme, in whatever form it is absolutely fantastic.
Joanna Trollope on the RNIB Talking Book Service.
I think in this day and age, modern medicine is so clever and so sophisticated, and we spend an enormous amount of time and energy and enthusiasm saving lives. But what the talking books do, and what the RNIB, I think, does in general, is save sanities before you know you get to the end of your life. The number of people whose lives have been transformed by talking books. I mean, the number of people who are visually impaired or blind who say that their lives have been absolutely changed. This is a lifeline. It's impossible to emphasise how important that is.
Broadcaster, columnist and chef Hardeep Singh Kohli is the Wigtown Book Festival guest director this year. As well as hosting a pop-up restaurant, he took part in a number of events over the 10 days. I asked him what it was like to be guest director.
It's been amazing. I love this place. I've been coming here for about 10 years, and this year, to be honest, for guest director, it's a massive honour. Just to be involved in, I mean, obviously cooking plenty of curries and the like, but also just been involved with some amazing sessions. I was interviewing Lisa Owens, whose debut novel, Not Working, is brilliant. Just been in a session listening to Abir Mukherjee and Jason Webster talking about crime writing, one set in Spain, one set in colonial India. It's just fascinating. Sean Williams, my old BBC colleague, was here earlier on. Kenneth Baker, the old Home Secretary, is here. I mean, some right good big hitters and some poetry about to start at 6 o'clock, so I'm looking forward to that.
Now, in one of the talks earlier, we heard about how the author was saying your job defined you, and you introduced yourself saying, I am a... What would your answer to that be?
Well, I'm a storyteller, because I'm from Glasgow, and that's what we do. But whether it's through food or through broadcasting or through books or through journalism or through stand-up, it's all story. It's all actually the creation of communities. You can't tell a story if you're on your own. Mm. And stories existed before fire. So long as there's two people, your core, you can tell stories. And I think, for me, that's the very essence of community. I'm a left-winger, I'm a socialist, I believe in community. That's where community comes from, great stories. We've got all the best stories on the left.
In the same way, I'm trying to put something in a box, and I shouldn't be, but can you define your book, Indian Takeaway?
Yeah, Indian Takeaway is a really interesting phenomenon for me, and probably more for me than anyone else. There you go, there's the ego speaking. I thought I was writing a book about my life growing up with food. It actually became a memoir. It became about stories of my growing up and about the links between, you know, being a Glaswegian brown kid and not always being accepted as being Scottish, but then in India clearly not being Indian and trying to find some kind of halfway house. And it is about people, it's about food, because food is about people. And it's about being Scottish and about, you know, the breaking of bread. I mean, that's why the Punjabi settled so well in the west of Scotland, because the door's always open. You're always having your tea, unlike Edinburgh, where you've had your tea. So for me, that's what it's about. It's kind of a journey through my own history, making sense of my duality and the dichotomy that I have about being Punjabi and Glaswegian and Scottish, and also making sense of that. And also, you know, food. I mean, you know, the greatest gift I think the Indian subcontinent's given this country, apart from the Kohinoor diamond, has been food. So I thought I'd take British food to India. And that worked as well as you imagined it might work.
Is there an underlying just love of words?
I do love language. I think for me, growing up, there was always an expectation that I wouldn't be able to speak English properly. You know, because I grew up in the 70s and, you know, where immigrants were coming over and English was their second language. English was my first language. And particularly when you're Scots and you've grown up with the amazing vernacular that we have in the west of Scotland and exposed to the great Lallan Scots, as we hear in Dumfries and Galloway now, but also the Doric tongue and the rest of, you know, kind of Burns's writing and Scott's writing and, you know, Alistair Gray's writing, Liz Lockhead's poetry, Janice Galloway, Jackie Kay. I mean, it lives on today. How can you not be in love with language? And Glaswegians, if you look to see who we've given the world in terms of songwriters and actors and poets, people that love language, and I think there is a precision to language, and for me precision was very important. People say, where'd you come from? Well, I come from Glasgow. I'm precisely from Glasgow. And for them, there can be, there's no lack of clarity in that. So for me, language is beautiful, because if I'm trying to make a point and communicate with you, I want to be absolutely sure that you know what I'm saying, and I want to be absolutely sure that I know what you're saying. And I'm a lawyer. I'm trained as a lawyer. What do you expect? I get paid more if I get my words right.
That echoes into the RNIB Talking Book Service, because what we are trying to make is a precise version of the print book. So, do you like audiobooks at all?
I don't often have time to read because I'm travelling a lot. And if I'm driving places, I used to get audiobooks to listen on the way. And when I was still married, we took the Waynes off to Canada and we listened to Stephen Fry reading the Harry Potters. And I think particularly when it's either the writer themselves reading their book or a great actor reading a book, it's a different experience altogether. I remember The Damned United, hearing David's book being read by John Sim. Now, I know and love John Sim, and to hear his voice telling a story that I was fascinated by, and I'm old enough to remember it happening at the time, was a different experience from reading. And I think I sometimes envy our blind citizens, and they've got that in spades. Do you know what I mean? They really appreciate the audiobook in a way I think a lot of folk haven't discovered it yet, you know?
West Stand car park. The kids hopping up and down on the back seat. No place to park, no place reserved. The press, the cameras and the lights, the fans, the autograph books and the pens. I open the door. I do up my cuffs. My eldest and my youngest hiding behind me. This one big bloke pushing his way through the press. "You're bloody late," he shouts, finger in my face. I look this one big bloke in the eye. I move his finger out my face and I tell him, "It's got nought to do with you whether I'm bloody late or not." They love me for what I'm not. They hate me for what I am.
Yeah, your big talk on Sunday where people are being invited to ask you anything. What are you expecting with that?
I've no idea. I just, funnily enough, I came up with that idea a few months ago and I just read it in the brochure. Then I kind of thought, why did I agree to do that? But I think there's something uniquely different about the Wigton Book Festival. Different from any other book festival, it's considerably less stuffy. It feels peopled by actual real folk. Folk you'd meet down the shops when you're getting your messages. Folk you meet down the pub. It's not the kind of the great and the good, although there's some great and good people here. The audience is just lovely folk. So for me, that's what community and storytelling is about. You asked me what I did. I'm telling stories. I just wish I knew what stories it was I was telling, but we'll find out on the day. It'll be fine.
Now, finally, what's been your highlight of the festival this year, or what do you think is going to be your highlight of the festival this year?
I'm really looking forward to closing the festival. It's a massive honour to be asked to do the final event. So I suppose that, in a way, is great. We've got a lovely dinner with Juno, who's a kind of a young adult author who's come up, transgender writer, a lovely, lovely soul. And I'm cooking for 24, and I love cooking, and I love cooking when it's around a table where the food isn't the conversation. The conversation is Juno. So for me, we get everything from that experience. But to be honest with you, I just love being in Wigton. I'm thinking about moving here. That'll be a laugh. Imagine that, the only brown in the village.
Still to come on today's Read On, recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival, are Susan Callan, Angus MacDonald, Helen Sedgwick, and much more. And next, we'll listen to one of the many discussions happening at the event, Where Does Capitalism Go From Here?
Love books? Well, R&IB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
The Wigtown Book Festival has much more than author events, with visual art, performance and film also in the programme. There are also discussion events with various topics from writing, politics and even the future of public libraries. Adrian Sykes of Money Week wrote They Made Great Britain. Alarmed to find that 23% of Britons thought Churchill was fictional, he decided to tell the story of the British Isles through 3,000 people, many Scots, and their innovations. He talks about his compendium of unexpected delights, which runs the gamut from the invention of mayonnaise to the origins of the phrase a nosy parker. I spoke to him after he'd been on the panel of a discussion event called Where Does Capitalism Go From Here?
We've just come out of a discussion group with four panellists on the future of capitalism. And I think that all four of us between us came up with absolutely no answers whatsoever. But we had a damn good shot at it. I've also written a book myself called Made in Britain, which is a history book about which I'll be talking tomorrow. I'm more confident about talking about that than I am about the future of capitalism, which is quite a large subject.
What can we expect tomorrow, then?
Well, there's a very nice interviewer called Stuart Kelly, who will, I suppose, be asking me the bits of the book that I like best. Maybe even if he asked me the parts that I like least, he'd get a franker answer. But it's generally just to point out to people that Britain, which doesn't sing its praises very often, is the most remarkable country that has existed for hundreds of years, in fact, since ancient Greece, probably, which played a similar role to Rome as we do to the United States. Also, the Americans don't seem to give us much credit for it because they mostly steal our inventions. And don't give us anything back. But we drew half the world's boundaries. The world is jealous of our democracy. They copy our legal system. In the last century alone, we invented the jet engine, penicillin, jointly with the Canadian insulin, television, radar. We were the first to split the atom. Even in the last decade of the century, the internet. There's nothing that Britain hasn't seriously affected the future and shaped the future of mankind. And we are not finished yet. Our contribution is mostly, in my opinion, yet to come. And of course, we're greatly aided by having given the world almost the best invention of all, which is our language, which is, curiously, ironically, the lingua franca of the world. You don't speak English, you don't trade. So I'm hoping that one or two people will buy the book.
Do you think that progress is out of proportion to the size of the country?
Yes, of course it is. Of course it is. I mean, it's a... And within that, I must add, since I'm at Wigtown, though within the United Kingdom, it's Scotland that has boxed above its weight. The inventions, the explorers, the... the British Empire was basically an English concept, won by Irish gallantry, which I'm afraid we regarded mostly as expendable. But when we were in trouble, it was the skirl of the pipes we wanted to hear when you were waiting in Lucknow to be put to the sword. Over the hill came the pipers, and followed that the soldiers. The Scots are a major, major component. They're only 10% of the population, but they're 25% of everything that's been achieved by this union. Very, very important.
Also on the panel discussing capitalism was Ian Fraser, author of Shredded, Inside RBS, the Bank That Broke Britain.
I think we all agreed that the existing form of capitalism is dead or dying, but we weren't able to really all agree on what the best solution is.
So it's the best of a bad bunch?
I think that's a good way of describing it. I mean, I think in my personal view is it does need serious reforms, and I did outline some of those in the session. But we saw from the banking crisis of 2008, where most of the world's banks effectively went bust and would not have survived without taxpayer-funded bailouts, that the model of capitalism up until that point had failed, because the corporate governance was bad, the incentives were bad, the control, the management control was bad, the risk management was bad, the whole ethos was bad, and if not corrupt. In fact, that was a word used by my colleague over there, Adrian Sykes. He used the word corruption, which is what he feels has crept in to the capitalist system. And the corruption he talks about is to do with short-term incentives and bonuses which drive people to break the law.
Now, you talk about that in your book, Shredded, Inside RBS. Tell us about that.
It's been widely praised by the critics. They think it basically describes how RBS went from being a well-managed institution which cared for its own customers, cared for its own staff, and, you know, was trusted as a consequence of that, into one of the least trusted institutions in the world, which didn't give a damn about its staff, didn't give a damn about its customers, and was happy to rob them effectively, either through mis-selling or, you know, cross-selling or giving them bad products. And you know, it's sad when it now has to take out ads saying, we promise we're not going to rob you. Mm. More or less, that's what this latest ads are saying. We may have you know, robbed you in the past or mistreated you in the past and effectively nicked your cash, but we are not going to do that now. That is quite, you know, the bank sector has come to a pretty pass when they have to take out ads along those lines. And Ian Martin, the speaker at the event, the chairman of the event, raised that topic. But no, overall, it's just the story of how what was a once trusted and much loved institution went completely off the rails under Fred Goodwin and nearly brought down the global economy in 2008 had it not been for Gordon Brown's intervention. And it's all the ins and outs of that, you know, who was doing what, where, why and when.
Were they completely at fault or were they part of a bigger crash?
There was a kind of prevailing ideology that came from Alan Greenspan, who was the chairman of the Federal Reserve from 86 onwards, which was that bankers could be trusted, which was that derivatives were good because they eliminated risk, that all central banks had to do was to target inflation, everything else would be fine. So there was a wider laissez-faire, let's say light-touch regulation. There was a culture where banks were doing these sorts of things, and it wasn't just RBS, you're quite right. Loads of banks were doing similar things.
Ian Fraser, author of Shredded, Inside RBS, The Bank That Broke Britain. And also you heard from Money Week, Adrian Sykes. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio, recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival. Now, how accessible is the festival as a blind person? I spoke to guide dog user Charlotte Benny.
Well, I live locally and I've been to every one, and I find coming along with a guide dog, we've never had any problems getting into events with my guide dogs over the years. And over the years, my guide dogs have been, as I say, tickled by Kate Ady, or I've had comments from Jeremy Bowen, Denise Miner, that they've met lots of famous people. So.
In the first instance, how do you consume your books?
RNIB, I'm just about to send off a new list, and I now also use iBooks on my phone. I get talking books that way. I like my books read by a real voice. I don't like an electronic voice. I put up with that on my computer.
So you're not a Braille user or a giant print user at all? It's all audio?
I do use Braille. I learnt Braille as an adult. The local social work department taught me Braille. I use it for my recipe books because I can't read Braille as fast as I read print when I was able to see. So I use it for instructions and, as I say, recipe books.
The events, I suppose, are catered for blind and partially sighted people because it is basically just people on stage talking.
Yes, that, and it's amazing how often I've either read books by that author or within a year or so I get a book that I've heard a talk on. For instance, at the moment I'm reading H's for Hawk as an iBook, and I saw the lady who wrote that, Helen MacDonald, here 2 years ago. Of course, I tend to order up my books, say, 40 at a time, 40 titles, so it can take me a wee while to work through. But and I still get my books on Daisy CD, and then we transfer them onto a Victor stream.
Would you recommend the festival as a blind or partially sighted person?
Yes, and as I say, they're well used to me and my guide dog coming along, so anybody else that came along with a guide dog or a white cane would probably have no bother.
Still to come, Susan Kalman on Cheer Up Love and Helen Sedgwick on The Comet Seekers. And next, we'll hear from Angus MacDonald on his book, Ardnish Was Home.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books, crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. I suppose favourite books, well, Roddy Doyle springs to mind, all the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me, and it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. Death to all dogs who enter here, we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge, sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. The hiss of the water and the earth so soft, bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there, staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books. And I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Audio description, which is sometimes abbreviated as AD in TV listings, is an extra audio track where a voice describes the action on screen just as subtitles display the dialogue. Here's an example from the movie Philomena.
Day, Martin is standing in the lobby of a restaurant. He looks out of the window and sees Philomena and Jane approaching. He greets them as they come in.
Hello, you must be Philomena and Martin.
Hello, Martin.
Hello again.
Hello.
We've got a table through here, after you. Just to the left. I must apologise for the other night. I'm afraid I was a bit... caught me in a bad moment.
Oh, that's all right. I'm just glad you managed to track me down. I hope you don't mind coming here. It's Mum's favourite.
No, it's very nice.
They arrive at the table and Martin gestures for them to sit down.
Find out more by visiting rnibconnectradio.org.uk.
Gallipoli, 1916. A young Lovett soldier, blinded by the Turks, falls in love with his nurse.
As they talk in the quiet hours, he recalls his life and that of his ancestors in the Western Highlands, so different to the enemy territory that the couple will soon have to cross to escape. A former soldier who now runs the Moidart Trust, I chatted to Angus MacDonald about his book, Ardnish Was Home.
I'm Angus MacDonald, I'm the author of Ardnish Was Home, and it's about a boy growing up in the West Highlands in a very remote community. And it tells the stories of life of making hay and making illegal whiskey and stalking the deer and gathering of the sheep. And anyway, our hero, who's 20 years old, goes off to fight in Gallipoli in the First World War in the Lovett Scouts. And on his train on the way south, he meets a girl. And anyway, he arrives in Gallipoli, and who should the girl be? But when he gets badly injured, the girl reappears as the nurse. And then they retreat through Bulgaria and Greece and back to Malta. And he is telling her his life growing up. And she, Louise, is also talking about the coal mining area of South Wales. So that is the story. There's a big twist right at the end of it. But basically it's a romantic Highland historical novel.
And the injury the soldier suffers is sight loss. Does that continue right the way through the book?
Yeah, so he's captured by the Turks and he's tortured and he loses complete eyesight for the first 2 weeks, and then one of his eyesight comes back to a very limited way, and the way he does his travelling is on a donkey, which features quite a major way. Mm. That's a really interesting point, actually, because I was very concerned about would it actually be possible for somebody to retreat for several hundred miles through enemy country when he couldn't see. He was also very badly injured in his shoulder, so he was very, very weak. But using a stick and working with the nurse and then the donkey is really how he managed to move around.
And tell us about your other work, because you're not only a novelist.
I left school at 17, so I didn't finish school. I then was incredibly lucky. I got into the army, B as an officer, left the army, and I managed to wangle my job in finance and investment management, and I loved that. And then I started a financial publishing company, and that did incredibly well. Now I've sold that to the Wall Street Journal. I have a number of other businesses in recycling and renewable energy and education.
And you're quite philanthropic in the way you're trying to boost business in the Highlands.
Yes. So I put 10% of what I make into a charitable trust, and it's all about stimulating the economy of the West Highlands to help people to build businesses, which will in turn sustain the communities where the people are from.
But you're still going to write a sequel to this novel as well?
Well, on the basis this one took 16 years, I'm not going to base my pension on it. But I'm very pleased by how well this one's been received. So I'm going to fast forward on the novel.
The Wigtown Book Festival has a number of diverse events for every sort of book lover. And the next event we'll look at deals with an epic history. Blood and Land is the history of Native North America, told by one of the world's experts. Jonathan King is the Von Hugo Fellow at the Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology at the University of Cambridge. In his book Blood and Land, he takes the desert southwest to the Canadian Arctic and all points in between, offering a narrative that defies the feathers and failure stereotypes, stressing instead native people's ingenuity and optimism.
The book is in a sense, absurdly ambitious. What I wanted to do was tell the whole story, and I want to tell it about Canada and the United States and bring in Greenland, and I wanted to try to give an overview. And it's a lunatic thing for a European to do, but I want to do it anyway, in part because nobody really tries to do it. And the second reason is that I wanted to bring in and discuss many of the myths that surround Native North America.
Traditionally, how did Native Americans or Indians deal with disability within their tribe?
Aha. That's a difficult one. that they had different ways of dealing with disability, and it's not something I really deal with. The example of disability that is always used is totally contrary to what we do, and it's what happens in the Arctic, and it's what happens to people who are ill or old. If you are out hunting or out on the land or traveling and you're in difficulties, and basically you leave them behind or you leave people to die. So they have a system of, or had a system of, in effect, euthanasia. It's not like us.
Now, we've had Neil McGregor on the show talking about how accessible the British Museum is. What goes through your mind if you're back in, when you were in your job, when you start to create a museum? Is there a thought of accessibility in there?
There is a thought of accessibility, and there have been many initiatives which began while I was at the museum. And so the British Museum was one of the earliest museums to have a Please Touch business and has deaf coils and all that kind of stuff. I suppose in retrospect we never did enough early enough, and so much, you know, I was at the museum for 30 or 40 years, so much has only really come in the last 20 years. We certainly didn't do enough early on.
I was the author of Blood and Land, the story of Native North America, Jonathan King. Now, Wigtown itself is near the Galloway Forest Park, the UK's first dark sky park. An appropriate location, given that the next book we'll hear is by Helen Sedgwick, called The Comet Seekers, a love story spanning 1,000 years, inspired by the night sky. Helen Sedgwick's impressive debut has been described as the time traveller's wife meets David Nicholls one day, and the audio version of The Comet Seekers is read by Helen Fox.
Why is it so small? Because it's far away. But what you mean is, why is it so faint? And that's because it's far away too. But it's moving towards us, so it's going to get brighter. When? Maybe later tonight. Are you sure? Maybe tomorrow? So what are we going to do tonight? He's getting cold already, out here in the dark. What with it not even being spring yet, not for a few weeks anyway. Tonight, we're going to watch it move, Roisin says, as she pulls her sleeping bag from inside the tent. If we lie here, we'll be able to see the sky all night long.
That's a clip of Michelle Fox reading The Comet Seekers by Helen Sedgwick. And I'm with Helen at a very windy Wigtown festival. Now, tell us about the book.
Well, the novel opens in Antarctica, where two strangers meet for the first time on a remote research base. And the novel then loops back over 1,000 years to show us what's happened both in their lives and in the lives of their ancestors to bring them to this point.
Now, it came from some flash fictions you did.
It did, originally, yes. A short story composed of 10 different, seemingly unconnected flash fictions. But as you read through the story, it becomes clear that each of them is set when there's a great comet visible in the skies overhead.
Had you known about how epic the book was going to be, would you have started out?
Possibly not. I don't know. It might have been a little intimidating. But the way I work, I just tend to get interested in an idea and then I follow it and I pursue it. And it's quite an organic process for me. So once I started writing about these different places, these different time periods with these amazing comets overhead, that was it. I was hooked.
And it's quite apt that you're reading the book today in a dark sky area.
Yes, it's wonderful, isn't it? I always love coming here because the skies are so amazing.
Liam crawls inside the tent. He's cold. He thinks that Roisin will follow him in, but he knows that's a stupid thing to think. She's never followed him anywhere. It's always the other way round. He takes Bobby out of the sleeping bag, brushes away at the bits of grass on the floor of the tent, and sits him up in the corner instead. But it's not fun being in the tent on his own, even with Bobby. So he forces himself to count to 100, and then he unzips the door again and looks out. Roisin is lying on her back in the sleeping bag. He drags his sleeping bag out of the tent, lays it along the grass next to Roisin, and wriggles inside. I'm back, he says, although she doesn't reply, and even if she did, all she'd say is that he is stating the obvious. He always seems to be doing that.
Now, the audio version, do you think that changes the reading experience?
I think it probably does. I must admit, I haven't listened to it all the way through yet. It lasts for 8 hours. I think it will be a strange experience to hear someone else's interpretation of my words, but I'm really looking forward to it.
Your interpretation of certain passages are obviously very tried and tested, and you read it without looking at the book today. That's quite an achievement.
Thank you. Yes, it was the first time in public that I've tried that, so I'm glad it went well. You know, it could have gone differently.
You were saying that your reading of the book, you've edited it and edited it. Do you think if you had read the audio version of the book, you couldn't resist that temptation to edit as you were going?
That would have been a big risk for me, yes. I think as I was going through, I would have wanted to change bits. And it's a never-ending process for me. I really could write and edit and write and edit forever, I think. Mm. And at some point with a book, you have to stop. But I also like the idea of allowing a reader space into the story. So I think having a professional actor read the book, they won't have quite so much of my intentions in mind, and perhaps that will then allow the reader in a bit more.
Is it hard to let it go?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it's always going to be hard, but it's something that I knew I was going to have to do. I work as an editor and I've worked in publishing, so I've seen so many writers have to do it. I was kind of prepared. And I started work on my next book very quickly after signing the book deal for The Comet Seekers, and I think that helped me pass it on and focus on something new.
One thing we don't get as blind and partially sighted listeners to the book is the cover. Can you briefly describe that for us?
Well, the cover is based on an original embroidery that was commissioned when the book was signed. It's a dark night and you can see embroidered comets soaring through the sky. Lower down, there's a snowy landscape with a bright red tent and a mother and son standing in front of the tent in silhouette.
Hold your breath and count, she says. If you count long enough and hold your breath long enough, you'll be able to see it move. Because it's flying. No, it's not. Yes, it is. It's flying so fast and so far away, it can change the whole sky in the time you can hold your breath for. It's the fastest thing in the solar system. You just have to hold on, and then you'll see.
The Comet Seekers by Helen Sedgwick, read by Helen Fox. Available commercially now. In a moment, we'll hear from Susan Kalman about her book, Cheer Up, Love. You're listening to Read On, recorded at the Wigtown Book Festival.
I cannot imagine not being able to read. I think it's one of the most profoundly important things you can do, because other people can tell you what they think, but the way to make up your own mind is to bounce off someone else's words. They're not talking at you, by and large, and even if they are talking at you from something like an RNIB talking book, they're there for you to play with. The author has given you permission to squeeze these words for all they're worth and take what you want.
Janice Galloway on supporting talking books.
I have friends who have lost their sight and know the awfulness, that the harrowing nature of not being able to read in particular books. They don't miss newspapers so much because there's the radio for the news, you can even listen to the telly. They don't miss a whole bunch of things, but what they profoundly miss is poetry. There is nothing more personal and intimate than reading a poem to yourself. And they profoundly miss contemporary books in particular, because you can get vast ranges of audio CDs and so on for classic books. But what they're really looking for is contemporary lit. And I was delighted to hear that Scottish RNIB was going to start bringing out contemporary Scottish literature, and that's what they're doing, and that means the world to me.
Susan Kalman spent a long time living with the crab of hate, her own version of the black dog of depression. She talks about this in her bittersweet memoir and how, after years of help and talking, she now realises she can be the most joyous, sad person you will ever meet. Susan herself reads the audio version of Cheer Up, Love.
Hello, welcome to this audiobook. If you bought it because you know who I am, welcome. If you bought it because you like the title, you have excellent taste. If you've been given it as a present, then please immediately thank whoever gave it to you, because they have excellent taste. If you have no idea why you're listening to this, then you're an impulse buyer and you should embrace that side of your personality. I too have bought things on a whim. It's why I'm reading this while wearing a fully functioning Batman costume. Just in case you've purchased this because of mistaken identity, let me start by introducing myself properly. My name is Susan Kalman, and at the time of writing this book, I'm 41 years old. I provide my age to you so you can place me in terms of your own history. If you're a youngster, you might think I'm far too old to understand young people things. Let me assure you, you're wrong. I'm absolutely down with youth activities like table tennis and gin. If you're older than me, then please be assured that I know a lot of people older than me, and we get on fine. In fact, some would say I'm an old soul in a young body. I like darts, snooker, and pubs with no music so you can have a decent conversation. I may in fact be a 60-year-old man from Yorkshire.
Susan Kalman reading from Cheer Up Love. She mentioned in her talk about how hard it is for her to take compliments, and at the Boswell Book Festival earlier in the year, the audience took that to heart and decided to offer an anti-compliment instead during the book signing at the end. I took a risk and did that too.
I saw your talk, which was awful.
Thanks very much indeed. You should explain why you've said that.
Oh, well, in the introduction. Okay. Now, what we've heard at the beginning was a clip of you reading your audio version mm-hmm. of Cheer Up Love. Mm-hmm. How was it actually reading it, revisiting it again?
It was really enjoyable because I do a lot of radio, so I actually write thinking about saying it out loud. Mm-hmm. So it felt quite natural, actually, because whenever I write anything, I think about what it would sound like. Mm-hmm. So to me, it was really enjoyable doing the audiobook, actually.
How was it to write, though?
It was difficult to write in some ways, but very easy in others, because some parts of it were very simple and explanatory. And then some areas I wrote and then put away again and didn't look at again. Mm-hmm. The slightly more difficult parts to write about. So it was a mixture of easy and quite painful.
It says writer on my passport, mainly because I figured comedian would cause problems when trying to gain entry to America. Saying that your job as a comedian is fraught with danger, especially when dealing with taxi drivers. The encounter usually goes one of two ways. Either they ask you to tell them a joke, in which case my whimsical feminist view on life fails to raise a laugh, or they tell you a joke, which can end badly for everyone. Before you get the wrong idea about me, let me be clear. I love taxi drivers. I really do. Especially when they utter my favourite passive-aggressive insult. Do you know who is funny? Kevin Bridges, Frankie Boyle, Billy Connolly, just repeat to fade. Honestly, the list is long. I'm a writer, as this book illustrates, but I suppose I'm probably better known as a comedian. If you're a Radio 4 fan, you'll have heard me on a multitude of shows like The News Quiz or I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue. If you've only heard me on the wireless and don't know what I look like, then let me assist. Imagine Angelina Jolie stuffed into the body of Kylie Minogue with a Scottish accent. If you've seen me on television in shows like Have I Got News For You or QI, you'll know that I just lied a bit. I'll talk about my height more as this book progresses, but suffice to say I'm short. I'm so short I can't see over counters, reach the card payment machines and petrol stations. And if I buy 3/4-length trousers, they're still too long for my tiny little legs.
Now, career-wise, I saw you at the stand a number of times hosting, and then suddenly you were on TV and radio. It seemed really quick. Was it that quick?
It wasn't quick. This is my 10th year in comedy, and I would say the first 6 years were not bad, but it was only when I started doing a bit of Radio 4 that things really picked up. So it's been a long slog to get to where I am just now. All of it valuable experience, but it's not been as quick as one might think.
Do you think your public profile gave you the voice to write this book?
I think there's no question that if you have a profile, publishers are interested in hearing your stories. So I think it is one of those things. My story is just one of many, but because I am slightly more well known, the publishers thought people would like to read it. So undoubtedly, if you become more well-known, you can write more about what you want to.
Now, it's not self-help, it's your story, but a sad fact of life is that if you start to lose your sight, you feel depressed. What would your advice be to someone who's starting to feel that?
I mean, it's very difficult, because I don't know how that feels, to be honest. Right. And I think part of the whole point of the book is to not make judgments on how people feel about their own depression. I do think trying to maintain communication with others, and by that I mean human communication, is very important. And so I would seek out other people to be honest with you. But I mean, it's as difficult as someone saying, trying to judge my depression. All I know is that talking is the most important thing that I've ever done about how I feel about my own depression.
I am Scottish, from Glasgow, to be precise, and I'd be very grateful if you could put aside any preconceptions you might have of my hometown while you're listening to this book. The media are often delighted to present my fellow Glaswegians as violent, drunken, drug-addicted louts filled with a dislike for the English. None of those tropes apply to me, and I'd hate you to think that any of the stories contained in these pages are a result of my innate Scottishness. It doesn't help my happiness quota living in a country where summer lasts for a week, but it's not the sole cause of my bleak outlook on life. But let's get to the point of why we're all here. Me. And as we commence this thrill ride together, I think it's appropriate that I come out. Not about that, you know. If you haven't worked out by the fact I'm wearing a Batman outfit that I'm a lady gay, then I can't help you. And don't worry, much like the short issue, you'll hear more stories of the fact I'm a very good friend of Dorothy later on. Those are the kind of juicy anecdotes that'll get this book discussed in the comments section of the Daily Mail. The coming out that I'm referring to is actually more difficult for me to admit than the fact that I'm gay, because the truth is that I have depression. In the past, I've been diagnosed as having clinical depression, but the medical diagnosis was, in a way, unnecessary. Some things, like a broken leg, are very obvious. You see, I'm not just a bit down sometimes, I'm depressed. I'm not like one of those little sad rabbits you sometimes see on a Hallmark card. I'm like a really upset Wookiee, full-on, world-hating, can't-stand-anything-or-anyone depression. For example, if I was to ask myself the standard happiness question, is this glass half full or half empty? I'd say, there is no glass. I don't deserve a glass. I'll drink out of this cup of broken dreams while looking at photos on Facebook of people I went to school with who have a better glass than me.
Susan Kalman reading from her book, Cheer Up Love. Available commercially now. Thanks to Adrian Turpin, Charlotte Gosling and everyone at the Wigtown Book Festival. For more information, head to wigtownbookfestival.com. If you're eligible to join, the RNIB Talking Book service is free, and you can access many of the audio versions of books featured at this and at past festivals and, well, over 25,000 other books. For more information, head to rnib.org.uk/books. Or to hear a book right now, head to the Talking Books pages of rnibconnectradio.org.uk. And read on, we'll be back in the studio at the same time next week.